Good morning, everyone, to today's session of the Personal Theology Program sponsored by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley. And I'd like to remind folks, this program has been going for over 40 years, and we're really pleased to be able to continue it, even though we can't meet in person. I also wanted to let people know, as a reminder, November is Native American Heritage Month. There are many programs on PBS that are just excellent if you want to search them out and watch them. I spent 4 hours last night watching these programs. Also on Tuesday on KQED at 8 o'clock, there's one about the Indian schools where kids were forcibly removed and put in this Carlisle school system in Pennsylvania. With that, I'd like to read our land acknowledgement. As we begin, we take this moment to acknowledge that this church occupies land in what was known as Huchin, the unceded territory of the Chochenyo-speaking Ohlone people. As community and church members, we continue to benefit from the seizure and occupation of this land. We also want to affirm that this is not simply performative, but is deeply felt and is a commitment toward action. Our speaker today is Wendy Knox Carr. Just a couple of things. Because of the wind, her Wi-Fi connection might be a little wobbly, and you also might want to turn up the volume just in case there are any problems from her end in terms of being able to deliver her message. Wendy is a UUCB member, and she serves on the Honoring Indigenous Peoples Group. She's also an author, a librarian archivist, a mother of four, and a book reviewer. And with that, I will turn it over to Wendy.
Okay, good to see everybody. So the title of this is We Have It In Us to Heal, Ancestral Memory, Tribalism, and Finding Our Way Forward in the Half-Light and Dark. And I put a TH in front of OUR because I need an inclusive personal pronoun to unify human beings at this particular time. So this is about four streams kind of coming together for me in the past couple of years. The first stream is misogyny and bullying. The second stream is reclaiming our bodies and healing our earth through understanding of our indigeneity and ancestral memory. The third stream is violence and police brutality, 1968 and through 70, Black Lives Matter, and Standing Rock, the upsurgence against climate change. And then I'm gathering it all together with the ideas of human evolution, from hunter-gatherers to tribalism to empire, and now to becoming co-members of our biosphere. So I am doing a lot of reading here. I'm taking a little lesson from Kendra Smith. And also this gives Anne and Lonnie a chance to fill in for me in case the wind blows down the Wi-Fi off the top of our building. So on the 7th of January, 2018, Oprah Winfrey at the Golden Globes said, "It is the insatiable dedication to uncovering the absolute truth that keeps us from turning a blind eye to corruption and to injustice, from turning a blind eye to tyrants and victims and secrets and lies. What I know for sure is that speaking our truth is the most powerful tool we all have." And this possessive pronoun, thou or truth, was invented in between the 2020 election and the time of January 6th Capitol riot. Because I was sick and tired of all the polarization that was tearing people apart inside and out, fueling the pretense that we are somehow separate from each other, separate from all our relations, our earth and her, his, and its beautiful culture and nature. I got tired of the dualism. I need something with movement in it, and I have learned that where I am being tired out or exhausted by something, I need to pay attention. Unitarian Universalists are a living religion, and it is part of our six sources that we grow and change. I think we have it in us to heal because it is encoded in our DNA. What the ancestors and our bodies have to teach us is survival in its many forms, particularly the survival of the spirit and soul along with the body we learned when we lived in small, tightly knit cultures. The vast majority of our lives here on Earth, before the empires, we have been in small tribes of hunter-gatherers, intimately connected with the land, weather, extended families, wildlife, and plants for our very survival. It also seems like our stress levels were a lot lower. At the present time, we have the amazing ability to communicate wirelessly around the globe in such a way that we might be able to use our human and humane gifts and our body memories along with our technologies in order to evolve a healthy planet. Humans have language, and when we began to hear consonants and not just vowels like other mammals, our communications manifested a geometric expansion, but we maintain many of our mammalian, animal, intuitive, emotional, and physical selves as well. We put this together with our large brains, requiring at least 6 months of intensive care and social support after birth, and have developed an amazing facial recognition, emotional, and body language system that is recognizable throughout the world for communication, getting our needs met with others, which I noticed when I reviewed Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life by Dacher Kelter. We are born wanting first and foremost to communicate, bond, reciprocally share, and negotiate with other humans, whether we share the same spoken and written languages or not. We can remember that, remember, in the sense of putting our bodies and ourselves back together from the inside out, and stretching out in seven generations, both backward and forward. Indigenous people like the Chichenyu-speaking Ohlone of the Bay Area and Monterey developed traditional spiritual, moral, pedagogical, and creative self-perpetuating systems that sustained them for 10,000 years or so in very small localized tribal areas, sharing seasonal food gathering areas and negotiating with each other with very little warlike conflict or friction. Very few eras of famine or epidemic disease. The wildlife, tree, grass, avian, and marine abundance here was spectacular. We know this because of some explorer and missionary records, but especially by archaeological examination of the shell mounds, which gave us an extremely clear aggregate history of what they ate, the tools and objects they used from day to day, and buried there with their dead, and were part of the ceremonies and watches conducted there for thousands of years. Since most tribes were deeply connected by intermarriage, intricate clan systems, and proximity, The elders, shamans, and matriarchs frequently settled disputes with only token hostilities. They were overwhelmed by very small numbers of armed Europeans because token warriors faced each other in line battles with single heroes challenging each other like David and Goliath in their traditional quote-unquote warfare. The conflict ended when someone was seriously injured. Harm to one in the community, especially a strong male hunter in the prime of life with a family, was a serious harm to all. And the elders had to immediately negotiate agreements and recompense to restore balance. Peoples with no organized military warfare or resistance to diseases were easily overwhelmed by Europeans with rifles, metal, deadly diseases, disruptive habits, animals, and military experience. More on that later. What's important now is to recognize that all humans developed in these actually very similar kinds of small communities all over the world for thousands and thousands of years before the advent of agriculture, hierarchies, loss of the goddesses and denigration of women, and the warehousing of goods, political power, and wealth controlled by the few became the model about 6,000 to 4,000 years ago. Let us hold that in mind. I started hearing healing stories in Christian Science Sunday School, where there were no priests or crucifixes, only a Father, Mother, God, and the spare declaration, God is love, over the reader's chairs in the sanctuary. Bible stories and understanding of human error, forgiveness, and the life of Jesus was the foundation of that religion, not sin or eternal punishment by an angry God. Mary Baker Eddy founded that religion in response to her strict Protestant fundamentalist upbringing. And my grandma did her best to stress positive powers of universal mind overcoming error, even though she had very firm ideas about how I was supposed to behave. My brother and I spent a great deal of time with our grandfather too, however, who loved camping and often took us for walks in the neighborhood and down to Lake Michigan to skip stones. Where he told us about geology, insects, birds, plants, and he was just a good listener and a loving presence. He was an agnostic scientist who had lost his theological faith after serving as a medic in France in World War I. More on him later, too. During high school, I went to Episcopalian church with my dad. I did not understand the ritual or theology I was partaking in at all. Mostly for the dynamic youth group, I hung out with the kids. I also tutored Black children in reading, and we understood that the associate pastor had gone south to support the bus boycott, but not exactly knowing what the civil rights movement was about. I grew up in a lily white suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is one of the most racist cities in the United States. Just north of Kenosha. In college, I learned yoga, dance, and meditation from people who had studied in India. I had been raised to be a decoration. I heard that from my meditation teacher when I was about 50 or 55, and I was so shocked to hear her say that. I was raised to be a decoration, but I really understood what she was saying. There's this idea of arm candy, don't talk about your own interests, ask him about football, all of these other ways to be a 1960s bimbo. Although I was very smart, well-read, and observant. Fast forward, when I was 33, after my second child was born with a disability, I was injured, and I was sick with chronic fatigue syndrome before it had been discovered. I went to therapy and learned two key pieces about my childhood. First of all, that the abuse I had suffered, particularly at the hands of my brother and his friends, and institutional and cultural stereotypes against women and girls, was not my fault. I had been holding on to oppressive depression, fear, shame, and guilt, and started the long road to try and break free. Secondly, after describing my early childhood, Joan, the therapist, said, "So, the two most unconditionally loving figures in your childhood were your dad and your grandfather. Is that correct?" Which completely floored me. I almost said, no, because I was so startled. But I knew in my heart, soul, and body, that was correct. That was a shock to what I had imagined and constructed in my childhood about our family, and where the mother was supposed to be all loving, cheerful, perfect, and supportive, like Dick, Jane, and Sally in the reading primers. I had actually felt the neglect, criticism, competitiveness, and control issues with my mother and grandmother, but had tried to deny it and block it out. Our dad and grandfather were really far more actively, consistently caring and protective of me, just the way I was. Even though they were not verbally or emotionally effusive, not able to be always present because of their work. So how to heal these sicknesses of body, mind, spirit, and world? I read up on lymphoma and other possible consequences of the kinds of symptoms I was having and decided to take a small trailer up to the shore of Lake Superior. I gave my two young children to their dads, slept, ate carefully, walked in nature, slept up to 14 hours a day, watched the sun, moon, sky, and lake, wrote in my journal, and read for almost 3 months. Nobody professional had prescribed that, but I wanted to regain my health and survive to mother our kids and write. During that time, I went up to the town of Grand Marais, full of people shopping and eating during the summer in Minnesota. I wandered into a small powwow outside of the town center and was absolutely transformed by what I saw, who the Indian people were around me, their beauty and dignity, and what I felt, particularly through the drums, singing, dancing movements, food, patterns of regalia and beadwork representing nature, and how the people greeted each other and accepted my quiet presence. I felt blessed. My health took a turn for the better. And when I described the powwow to my mother, she said, "You know, my grandmother was a Chippewa Indian from Canada," because her dad, that is my grandfather, had told her that before he died. He had spent a lot of time with her when he was little because he had a bad accident and did not want to be left alone at his parents' cabin. She'd been widowed for many years and enjoyed his company. In that 1986 healing crisis, I also had the experience of going into a gift shop and seeing a book about logging and forestry in northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And it had a picture from about 1880 or 1900 or so, about the time my grandfather was a boy, of tall, straight trees with no underbrush. It was before the trees were all cut down to make lumber for settlers' farms and all the homes in Minneapolis, Milwaukee, and Chicago. It looked like the redwood forests I'd seen in parks on the coast, but it was all scrubby and overgrown. There were also three maps of how the forests in the United States were reduced from 1780 to 1880 to the 1980s. They were denuded of trees and wild land And it also got me thinking about what was to become ecology and the realization of the genocide of the indigenous people who had thrived there. Up until that time, I had thought the Indians were a dying race, savages, and had all been assimilated into American society. But there they were, singing and dancing and celebrating it was summer again. And my grandma, great-great-grandma, and I had been connected to them. Now, Eve Tuck and Kay Wayne Yang, in their excellent essay, "Decolonization is Not a Metaphor," quote Vine Deloria Jr. as saying that all of the people who have come up to him in his life saying they have an Indian grandmother or great-grandmother are trying to do what he calls play Indian, and were somehow invalid, appropriating, or artificial. But I think he's not only glossing over the misogyny of that statement, but also trying to sidestep the fact that his great-grandfather was a white U.S. Army general, Indian fighter, who married a Yankton Sioux woman, and he and his ancestors also used any privilege of mixed race, white background to survive. As we saw in the Anne Marie Sayers video a couple of weeks ago, if women saw their husbands and sons murdered, they told their daughters to say they were Spanish or Mexican, the way my great-great-grandmother and her French-Canadian husband did, because race prejudice, discrimination, and hatred of Indian people were still very much alive. I use the term Indian because that's what we called ourselves in those days. American Indian Movement, et cetera, et cetera. Before and during this time, I had been involved with the women poets of the Twin Cities, neo-paganism and circle practice, which was a blending of a lot of Northern European revivals of our indigenous spirituality, our stories, myth, and practices, and the women's movement with a sense of gender equality and a recognition of our interdependence with the natural world was part of my practice. I was particularly impressed by the archaeological European goddess imagery revealed by Maricha Gimbutas, psychological theories by Erich Neumann and C.G. Jung, the theories of the Great Mother, the feminine, and books like Brianne Eisler's The Chalice and the Blade, which encouraged us to move from a dominator model to something more cooperative. Violence, colonization, and warfare arose in the empires of Alexander, the Roman Empire, the Persians, and the invasions of the Mongol Khans, among others. As we heard from Matthew Fox, the theological powers of these times arose and have arisen like the Catholic and Protestant conflicts after the Black Death to inspire violence, misogyny, intolerance, and race war, and present articles of faith, papal bulls, and doctrines of dominion to facilitate and justify the domination of nations, people, trade, commerce, and lands. It is necessary to face these theological histories and rebalance the realities of cruelty that have been condoned, lied about, and concealed. The American Indian Movement paved the way for the Standing Rock Pipeline resistance, and I had heard Russell Means speak at McAllister College in the early 1970s. He impressed me very much by not talking about himself or what he had done or what he wanted, but everything being couched in terms of the people, by which he meant his community, his entire tribe. The people need this. The people told me XYZ. The people. His large voice echoed out of his barrel chest in the same way that my grandfather's had when he laughed or when we got too close to the water and he called out to us. He listened to the elders, That is how he learned from his grandmother and how I learned from him. Firmly, not loudly, but with great resonance and grounding, and often with a joke or a story. He and Russell Means had learned from the people, and the people had learned from their ancestors and from nature, the wisdom and the frailties of the Creator, and the wonderful intricacies of abundant creation on Mother Earth. I have started to understand that I have learned, listened, experienced, and observed too. And now it is time for me to share my stories. I had witnessed police brutality firsthand in the 60s and early 1970s at the University of Wisconsin-Madison during the Vietnam War protests against the military-industrial complex, as well as the militarization of campus with the National Guard, the news of Kent State killings that happened in Ohio. And then I left Madison after my fiance entered the Army to avoid getting drafted. Now at this point, we're gonna take a little break to do some questions and answers. And we were wondering if other people had realized that we were raised to be a decoration or had other aha moments about our gender roles.
So if you have a question, if you could please use the raise your hand function, and then we will call on you in order. Thank you. I'll respond, Wendy. I had three older brothers, and then I showed up. I was supposed to be named Bill. They've given up on getting a girl.
Yeah, I was supposed to be Wendell Jr. and have red hair.
Okay. And so I always felt that I was, in my family, that everybody was glad that they had gotten a girl. But I do understand what you're saying about being a decoration. The thing is, I didn't really fit that thing of being a decoration. I wasn't that kind of a girl. So my response was to be as good as I could be at scholastic stuff, because I figured out my parents really valued education. They insisted that all four of us would go to college because they didn't get to. So I focused on that because I knew I couldn't fill the role, so to speak, by being a decoration. So I appreciate you pointing that out. Let's see, Marcia.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, I've always been chubby or not what you're supposed to be pretty, to be the decoration. So even though I have had important, deep relationships with men, they weren't because I was pretty. But I wanted to share with you, I was working on a play until very recently when the man who's the playwright and the prime mover of it died recently. But anyhow, the play, the name of the play was Stardom, and it was a myth of Ava and Tar, like Avatar, man and woman who were moving through history, learning to be the man and woman that we are archetypally. And each one of the planets has something to teach man or woman, like Mars teaches man to be a hunter and a fighter and a warrior. And when we did a workshop production of this play, I played several parts, and because we didn't have a whole lot of actors, and I ended up playing Venus, and I had to do her song, which was teaching woman to, quote, stay pretty. If you want to keep your man, you got to stay pretty. And I had to sing that song, and it was heartbreaking to come out of my throat. I just hated it. And I knew it was true too, that that's what I was supposed to be, pretty, if I wanted to survive. And of course I hadn't gone that road, so I knew it wasn't the only road, but boy, oh boy, I wasn't normal. It wasn't the norm. The norm was for a girl to grow up and get a man to take care of her and stay pretty so he will continue to take care of her. And I just thought I would share that.
Thanks, Marcia. Ann Harlow?
Yeah, I was hoping Wendy could clarify something. You talk about your grandfather who you knew well and who was very unconditional love. And then you talked about your mother and her grandparents, her grandmother having been Native American or First Tribes Canadian. I couldn't tell if it was the same grandfather, or it sounded like you felt like your grandfather was your mother's father, and that he had sort of grown up with some of this tribal wisdom, but you never knew he was a member of a tribe. Is that right?
No one ever knew until his deathbed.
Wow.
That was how bad the prejudice in northern Wisconsin was against the Indian people. There, you know, there were signs in the windows of stores and restaurants and bars and stuff that said, no dogs or Indians. And that lasted, you know, it's still going on with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, and the co-optation of tribal governments and things like that. But my great-great-grandmother was married to a French-Canadian man. She was 15 years old. Who knows whether she, you know, was sexually trafficked or she was getting out of a residential school by marrying this guy or whatever, you know, but she was 15 years old and came down from Canada. And his name was Marcanot, French Canadian, but they spelled it with an O at the end instead of E-A-U. So they said that they told people that they were Spanish because it was better to be Spanish than to be French Canadian or First Nations. So that was my great great grandma.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't have thought anybody would have been Spanish in Minnesota at that time. Or Mexican.
Well, you know, it was just a sense that everybody, there were a lot of people moving around and a lot of people coming in through the Great Lakes in particular. Because people were familiar with the Spaniards and the Mexicans coming from the South, that it was easier to pass yourself off as a Spanish or Mexican person.
So the name went from Martino to Martino.
And what?
So the name went from Martino to Martino. And that's what your mother
yes.
grew up
yes.
in.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. There's not any more questions right now, Wendy, so feel free to proceed.
Okay. I was going to tell Marcia also, Jane Fonda was in a movie in the 1960s made by a French woman who was wife of a filmmaker. And the title of that movie was Be Pretty and Shut Up. And that was the message. Okay, so bringing some of these other threads together. In 1994, I was on jury duty in Minneapolis in a violent case and was eventually excused from the jury because our family and my bookstore were caught between the white police law enforcement departments and the African American and poor white gangs who were committing most of the property crimes. There was a war going on right under everybody's noses, even in 1994. Both sides were fueled by guns, drugs, compulsions, vengeance, and violent attitudes. All of it had been kept invisible to the general middle and upper class, mostly white populace. And it stayed that way almost until Mr. George Perry Floyd died under Derek Chauvin's knee. I used to stand on that bus stop with my Black friend, Roy McBride, one of my poetry mentors, where Mr. Floyd died. So after 9/11, I entered a First Nations Library and Archives program in Vancouver, Canada in 2002 to get away from the war in Iraq, the shock and awe bombing, looting of the museums, and glorification of the destruction on TV. And I became a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church for the first time, although I was aware of UUs from the Unity Unitarian Church on Holly Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota. I was particularly drawn in by the principles and later the sources because I had gone back to school for a minor in religious studies after my healing crisis. I had started with a class in East Asian religions, moved westward through China and India, had taken women in Judaism, Old Testament, New Testament, and a seminar on the Synoptic Gospels that helped me see the Bible as literature inspired by a God, but written by human beings, particular victorious human beings. When I got to Hosea in the Old Testament, I understood that it was a misogynist, militarist piece of propaganda. That was quite a revelation. After I experienced my grandson's terrorizing ritual circumcision bris, I was no longer part of Abrahamic covenant. I was a goddess worshiper and wanted bodies left whole. When I moved into my apartment complex in Berkeley, part of the housing contract I had to sign here had a clause about bullying, a definition I had never seen before. Bullying includes comments or conduct intended to intimidate, humiliate, or isolate people in a way that causes physical or emotional distress. A definition of bullying. I have been working through that for over 6 years. This clearly declared and described the massive internal and external structure I had been struggling with my entire life. Between that and a year-long study group on Hannah Arendt and the origins of totalitarianism, a book that, it examined the rise of Nazi and Stalinist domination and the horrors thereof. I was completely ready to predict and interpret the rise of Donald Trump and the necessity to oppose and deconstruct their powers, theories, and actions on every hand. Reach out, organize community, and support alternative structures wherever I could. There is resonance for all those nonviolent community organizations, consciousness raisings, and actions that have arisen through this period, including Oprah Winfrey's Time's Up speech at the Golden Globes, the Black Lives Matter responses to Ferguson through the horrific murder of George Perry Floyd, and subsequent conviction of Derek Chauvin, the upsurge of the Wall of Moms, Wall of Many, and even through the January 6th insurrection of this year, and definitely through the climate crisis resistance. If you want to know why so many Americans think it is not only their right to fight back violently against racial, sexual, gender, and even healthcare and infrastructure change, we have not only to look to the roots of the American Civil War, but back where 15/16 of my ancestors came from in peasant classes of Europe. or second, third, and fourth sons and daughters of the middle class or an aristocracy who were not able to inherit land or wealth in the old country. They became the founding fathers and mothers. Benjamin Franklin tried to imitate the Iroquois Confederacy by requiring three separate branches of government, but he couldn't squeeze in the outer circle of matriarchs who gave the thumbs up or thumbs down about important issues like waging war. The American root system is a really tough bunch. The Harlan, Kentucky chapter of Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, The Story of Success, that's Malcolm Gladwell, has a penetrating description of feuding clans in American Appalachia. Their extreme violence, tribalism, and our unshakable, vengeful code of honor at its worst. Gladwell posits that tribal violence patterns in the United States came from people with backgrounds of herders in not very fertile landscapes who had to guard their flocks defensively and violently to maintain their existences. The code of honor, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth ethic, caused constant friction. Unlike tribes from abundant areas where peace was maintained through ritual agricultural practices, a balance with the natural world, and shared circles of negotiation and power. Our own clans, crofts, and villages were frequently confiscated by the aristocracy or Industrial Revolution corporations who evicted our forebears in actions like the enclosures of the late 1700s that destroyed the commons and forests, let landowners evict tenant farmers from their ancestral homes, brought sheep to Scotland and Ireland where the potato famine and illnesses added to the misery and made immigrants of thousands of people, first to the slums of the cities and then to the colonies. Our ancestral wells, springs, and rivers were capped, pumped dry, polluted, and rerouted. Wildlife and cattle sources slaughtered or confiscated. Oral traditions, cultural and social customs, courtesies, elders and children scattered to the winds, destroying our economic and subsistence sources the same way we did to Indigenous people of the Americas when we came here. We starved, murdered, terrorized, hounded, and spread disease in populations who had previously prospered in semi-ecological harmony. They were supported by their own ancestral oral traditions, spiritual belief systems, and land-based rituals. Like the Romans did to the bards and the druids in Scotland and Ireland, the first people they got rid of were the knowledge holders, the elders, the oral traditions, the people who spread the knowledge and information of how to live in balance with the world through oral traditions rather than written. We did unto others as had been done to us, and it caused the same kind, if not vastly worse, suffering and imbalance. This is the vein of spite, resentment, classism, fear, and hatred that Donald Trump and his supporters tap into. It was bullying when the aristocrats did it to us, them, and it was bullying when they decimated the indigenous people of the Americas and enslaved the peoples of Africa, India, Southeast Asia, and China to work and build our cotton plantations, the Congress building, and railroads. We are still doing it with palm oil plantations in Central America and Mexican maquiladores just across the border, where women are locked in for 12-hour days sewing Fruit of the Loom underwear, the way we worked out our needs and our demands with banana republics in the 50s and 60s, undermining democracies with the CIA, voter fraud, and corporate greed. We are not crazy or stupid when we identify these human politicized actions as bullying and cruelty and speak out. We know it when we see it. They are intended to humiliate, isolate, and intimidate others physically and emotionally. Remember what Oprah said. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. Mr. Floyd called out to us when he said, "Mama, I'm through," and gave up the ghost before our eyes, just as William Wallace called out to the witnesses of his execution by the British for freedom. You mute your mic, please. Many of us felt justice was done when we heard the 3 counts of guilty against Mr. Floyd's state-employed assassin. Many of us feel the same deep passion that Oprah Winfrey expressed when she said again and again, "Their time is up." When we have the public intention, we use it to speak our truth with whatever skills we have. Like it or not, you are our brothers, our sisters, our parents, our children, our neighbors, our past, and our future. But what was done to us must not be turned around and done to others. This is the gift not only of psychotherapy, mythology, and Jungian dream work, but common sense and healing religion back through Jesus of Nazareth into the balance-based shamanism of the hunter-gatherers. The gift of Homo sapiens is the ability to stop, pause, and think before an emotional or intuitive reaction. We are choosing, making choices all the time. The only way to survive on this planet is to really embrace the 1st and 7th principles. Struggle with the 2nd through the 6th. Confirm and practice the 8th principle and ground down into our neurological, cultural, soul, and physical roots, which are ingrained by our past evolution, to want to love and support each other in an abundant natural environment, a small community, as well as look outward to an ever-changing possibility of the re-evolution of our creation. We have it in us to heal.
Thank you, Wendy. So let's all take a deep breath. We can open it up to questions. I would like to say at this point, I appreciate not only your remarks and the thoughtfulness that you put into them, but this is you're another example to me of the wealth of information and wisdom that the members of our church provide. And I really appreciate your willingness to show your vulnerability and your background and to share that story with us. Not only is it a good way for us to get to know each other, but to understand what a treasure we have in our membership, all of us.
I would not have been able to make those thoughts and that synthesis without the resonance of all the many, many groups that I've been involved with over the past 6 years, particularly Unitarian Universalist groups, but also Indivisible Berkeley and other, you know, supportive groups of people who share thoughts that are different than the media and the barrage that we get about just all of this really divisive, nasty stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, something was going on during the Clinton administration, and he said, you know, we just got to stop with all of this damaging, divisive talk that goes on, just pounding us with all of this pain. And I was talking with some of my friends here last night about how I can't watch the news. I mean, I used to watch the news just like 3 hours Friday night on PBS. And now, you know, for the past 6 weeks, I haven't watched it at all. And I felt really, really good because I've been doing a whole lot of creative work otherwise and being with like-minded people.
So. Thank you. So again, if you want to ask a question, please use the chat function to raise your hand, and Lonnie's got her hand up.
So Wendy, I would add the word terrorism. I think bullying and humiliating is, you know, they're nice euphemisms, but there's groups that terrorize other groups, that yank them from their home, that lynch them on trees. This is terrorizing. Mm-hmm. And so yet, as you said, don't want it done to their families. And so this very simple, simple idea that we're all one, that I don't want to do to you what I don't want done to me. It seems so simple. And so I have a major disconnect and tears when you look at the inhumanity. And yes, I know that the veils, I know spiritual people here, you know, Marsha Kimmel, you know, a whole bunch of people here that know that the veils are getting thinner, that we're getting more conscious as we go along, and that this truth keeps coming out. And being an astrologer since I've learned astrology in the mid-60s, we saw this time coming where the patriarchy would be so challenged that we would see the collapse of governments, we would see the change of governments. We just didn't have an idea of how deeply it would fight for its life to stay in existence. That we did not know. And we could not have, well, some people could have predicted a Trump. So my question is, the hopefulness, where is your hopefulness in all of this understanding? What, I mean, are you hiding out or are you hopeful?
So when we went through a whole lot of consciousness raising for the women's movement, Sandy, can you please mute your mic? Thank you. So when we went through, Sandy Nixon, please mute your mic. So when we went through the consciousness raising of the women's movement, we all thought, oh, of course, all we have to do is tell people that things are imbalanced and everything's going to be just fine. And we went out and we told people, and they just went along like, that's nice, dear, pat you on the head, you know, and ignored it. And I got real depressed for a while. And when I had my two kids, I had a revelation that it was not going to happen during my lifetime. And that was bad. That felt really bad. And I had this image that I was down in a pit with my two little girls. And I was pushing them up towards the light. And they were going to get out of it. Even if I didn't get out of it, God damn it, they were going to get out of it. And that's what keeps me going. And I feel just in my heart the same way, you know, not as you do, I am absolutely sure. But all of these movements are going the same direction. We've got to get our shit together if we're going to survive. And, you know, I'm just going to keep on pushing those kids up out into the light. That's where my hope comes from. I have no choice. I will not go back. I will not live in fear. That's what Penny Opal Plant said. I will not live in fear. I will not go back. People don't understand that we belong to each other. That's what Mother Teresa said. We belong to each other. We must go towards the light. Sorry.
Thank you. Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you, Wendy. Thank you.
Let's see, Marcia. Thank you, Wendy.
Hi. Thank you. Because I, this is something that concerns me and has concerned me. When Trump got elected, I got so depressed and so triggered, having been bullied all my life. I knew a bully when I saw one. And I, one of the things that would depress me ever was having a problem and not being able to solve it, not being powerful in any way to change it. And I just felt that way with Trump. I mean, he was at the top of the heap. So at the time, I was working with a television, community television production company, Overcomers with Hope, OWH. And they asked me to do the first time for a TV show. Anyhow, you know what I mean. So I designed a TV show that I wanted to do, and it was called Wake Up Oakland. And it was each episode was about a different subject. That was the idea, that we would take on a big subject. And so the first one for that first show was bullying. And then the idea was to shed light on that subject from a lot of different angles. And it helped pop me out of that depression, because then I had something that I could do, something I could contribute. And there was one thing that we did a man on the street section over at Lake Merritt, and asked people, various people, of all the people who are around the world today, who would you say is a bully? Oh, people said, Trump. So we just put that in at different places. Trump. You know, in answer to the question, who's a bully in our world today? But he really is the top of the heap of the bully movement. They want their guns. They want, so anyhow, rather than go on and on, because we all know this, how, I just don't know, how do we break through to that other consciousness that we are all one? We're all, you are me and I am you, and we need each other. We need the men, we need the women, we need to be partners. All I know is art and culture, to use those two forces in life, because they seem to bring people together in a way that they, you know, take off the armor, and they can have something to eat, and they can enjoy, they can sing, they can dance. That's my only contribution now. Let's do it that way.
A lot of that is, you know, the powers of Venus.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
You know, that keeps getting kind of eclipsed. You know, the emotional, family, personal life, and the creative powers, and the nurturant family things that mostly women are doing as a matter of course, but a lot of men are understanding, are really the things that give us joy as human beings, you know, interconnecting with others, you know, the hero myth, you know, I can fix everything. Just not working. It's not sustainable. And both, you know, it's the power of the people is not going to stop. I mean, it's like a whole lot of upsurgence and connection just keeps moving up from all of the little people. And one of the a Filipino American farm worker, Lillian Fabros, said one of the lessons that she learned from the Third World Strike and the ethnic studies movement at Cal was to use whatever skills you've got and find the goal that you are passionate about. And move with whatever skills that you've got to head towards the ethics and the creative possibilities that you have in your community. I mean, that's why I'm writing for the Berkeley Times, which is a print and newspaper, you know, journal that has a distribution of 5,000. You know, it's like that's my community, and that I can manage. There are a whole lot of things that I can't manage. If I try and think about the big picture and doing everything for everybody, it doesn't work. That's just that is really depressing. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of women are stuck with. It's like we've got to take care of it. When there's a problem, we've got to take care of it, you know, because we think it's our fault. And that's part of being trained to be a decoration. We're quietly, silently cleaning up. And burning out on volunteer work and things like that. But the way we can really engage with some traction is to focus on what we as individuals, unique individuals, are inspired by and capable of doing. And it, you know, it's enough. And to understand that there are others. It's like, you know, leaves of grass. There are thousands of others who feel the same way. That's the other part of connecting with people during this time. You know, to see the wall of moms just kind of arise, you know, and say, he was calling to me, baby, when he said, mama. You know, to just grab that and say, that gives me power. You know. And it just say, okay, I can move forward. If I'm there with 300 other people with yellow t-shirts, I'm gonna feel better and I'm gonna keep on moving. And I really believe that all of the postcards and all of the things that Indivisible all over the country did got Biden elected and really just sabotaged that machine that was going to run us over for another 4 years. So
thanks, Wendy. Are there any other questions?
I think we had Kristen. Kristen, Kristen Jensen, are you still up for your question?
I wasn't sure when it ended, so I took my hand down, not to go over time.
No, yeah, 10:45. We're good.
Okay. Well, I love the thoughts you're sharing, Wendy, and your history. Thank you. It's wonderful to be in the room with the virtual room with everyone thinking about these issues. And one thing I just want to comment on is, you know, briefly, when I lived in Portland in the 2000s, kind of came across some people in the men's movement, and they really were doing work on you know, how when they're boys, they're being bullied into becoming bullies out of wanting to save themselves, you know, from homophobic violence, and, you know, they're being called sissies and so forth. So that work, you know, is another positive, I think, that they were trying to reclaim their humanity and sensitivity by healing those traumas. So it's just another pinpoint of light, I think, of hope.
Yeah, I have been very, very inspired over the past decade by Michael Mead, who worked with Robert Bly and James Hillman on the Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, a collection of poems that came out of the men's movement. And you know, he goes back to songs and stories and mythology, and he's very into Jungian archetypes, and he has worked with Mosaic Multicultural to particularly do workshops with men, you know, and you know, he does, you know, several mixed group kind of ritual weekends and things that I've participated in, that are very moving. But he has a similar kind of understanding that each of us has a unique calling and a unique life that, you know, when we're, you know, initiated either tribally or through things that happen in our lives, we turn towards that capability. And that because of the collective unconscious and the you know, the unity of creation, a whole lot of us tend to be doing this same kind of discovery at the same time. And that's what's going to move us forward. So that's definitely going on. And it's beautiful because there's so much pain. There's, you know, men, women, and particularly young people. It's been devastating. So the healing has to really go on.
Wendy, one of your statements, I don't know if I can find it, but it was the one about choice, that we as, you know, my favorite thing to say is that, you know, human mammals, our primate, us, came after the dinosaurs were wiped out, and we were these little mole rats that then grew into, you know, tigers and lions and humans, and all the mammals came from this little, you know, these little beasties that were left after the dinosaurs. And we all understand about fight, flight, freeze, you know, that's part of that back part of our brain. We cannot forget the biology of what we're doing. I think personally, we're amazing for being these little mole rats, you know, that are growing, that are evolving. But our job is frontal lobe choice now. We cannot keep using the reptilian part of our brain. But yet we all have fear. It's no longer the saber-tooth tiger. It may be my boss, it may be my colleague, it may be my children, it may be my friends, you know, anything that causes me fear, I'm going to have that animal reaction. And how we support that and understand that, at the same time, try to get choice. Like you said, you know, we are in a unique position to choose. I just love that. I think, you know. Thank you.
And all of the meditation groups and things like that are so good because, you know, I feel like they have taught me to stop. And, you know, it's like, I'm feeling an emotion, like outrage, or, you know, I hate myself, or whatever this feeling is, and to breathe and to be aware of what it's doing in my brain and my body. You know, I mean, going out to Spirit Rock for a week, you know, and things like that. You know, it's just it's so strange for the American lifestyle. But to be able to breathe, become aware, to think, and then to choose is the gift of the human being. Mm-hmm. And not just the reaction. I mean, that Harlan, Kentucky chapter of Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers is just sad. I mean, it's all of these feuding families, you know, the Howards and the Turnbulls and the Hatfields and the McCoys, and, you know, it goes back hundreds of years, and it's horrible violence and murder. I mean, it was like, you know, 1,000 people, you know, were killed in this one valley of only 10,000 people population. I mean, a tenth of the population was going around killing each other. So it's like, yes, we've got that. And how do we stop, think, massage a little bit.
Wendy, have you read the book Braiding Sweetgrass yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Yeah, I started reading it. I haven't gotten very far. I'm going to go back and start it again because I've decided it's a book that's important enough that I'm going to need to highlight specific areas. But the one thing at the very beginning that she's talking about is the idea of how Indigenous peoples worked more on a gift economy as opposed to like, I've got this, you buy it. It's all based on like the money economy. And that's an interesting idea. And I don't have any firm thoughts about it yet, but I just wanted to put it out there that this might be a very interesting book for people to read. It is on the bestseller list.
Yeah, Braiding Sweetgrass. And that's very much where Malcolm Margolin starts out with the Ohlone Way. Mm-hmm. He's got this thing where a woman goes out and she's gathering seeds because she has a wonder, a hereditary plot where the grass grows really lush and rich and she gets lots of seeds and all this. And so she's coming back into the village with her big basket of seeds. And the first thing that comes to mind is, oh, I have to share these. You know, she sees somebody's, you know, sort of envious glance. And her first thought is, this must go out to the other people in the tribe. Because envy and greed are like the worst emotions that you can show in the community. And it's just a whole different mindset. It's so good.
Well, it is. And just to put a little plug in for the church is doing this thing this week where you can take all kinds of items up to the church, whether it be food or clothing, you know, warm clothing for people. There's really a lot going on this week. So you might want to check out the website. I was just reading about it this morning. I'm like, oh, I've got to, you know, sort out my clothes. I need to get out, go through my coats, you know, see what I can donate for the food for the holidays type thing. But it's much more than that. They've got a lot.
You're muted, that last part.
Sorry. I was just talking about how the church is doing all these things to, donate food and warm clothing, and they've got fix-it clinics, and so you can have these small items repaired or little sewing jobs so that we don't end up throwing out so much stuff. But it's on the website. It's also in the newsletter.
I think today's service has a theme about.
Oh, good. Wonderful. Thanks, Anne. So, well, thank you, Wendy. Appreciate you putting yourself out there. And thanks, everyone, for attending.
Good. Carol's hands.
Hope to see you on December 5th for James Beres.
Thanks, Wendy.
Yep. Thank you so much. Take care.
All right. Bye, everyone. See you at service. Bye.